This was a week chock full of news, but it wasn't the news media's finest hour.
They just kept showing the same clips over and over again, and it was always the most horrifying clip.
We don't have people who work at Runner's World come here because they didn't get a job as a war correspondent, so they came to Runner's World.
We have reports that they have explosives here at the scene. There are explosives here at the scene.
Within the first 24 hours, people were still... And if we started talking only about other things, people would have gone looking for it.
When they run out of data, they just fill it with blather.
At the end of the day, someone is going to be right.
Yeah.
Because every news organization is reporting something different. Pick your conclusion.
There really is a thrill to being the first, or being as close to the first as possible to report a story.
More coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Okay, I want this area cordoned off. It's a crime scene. Let's get it secure, please.
It's impossible to keep up with the news this week, especially in a pre-recorded show. As I read this, it's closing in on Friday evening. At 4 a.m. this morning, I was following On the Media's Twitter stream, manned by producer Alex Goldman, who was tweeting the Boston Police Department scanner.
Come right now. Push those units. Push that ALS unit off the down. Where is that ALS unit? Please!
They're working it. They're trying to get them there.
It was a movie without pictures, a shootout, a car chase, and we had the newly dead, a campus police officer, a suspect, bombs reportedly strapped to his chest.
We're going through the yards, or do they have both of them?
The last update we have, two FTs, one in custody, one down on the ground at gunpoint, not in custody yet.
All right, call Watertown, and get a confirmation of how many we have down. Please, I will say on two.
You just be advised, Watertown is not answering the phones right now. We'll try.
This was a surreal week, a dread-soaked week, with rice and tainted letters in Washington, explosions in Texas, a popular gun control bill going down in flames, a major metropolis in lockdown. And yet, with all that news... It was a bad week for the media, across all platforms. In our never-ending news cycle, breaking news usually reveals what's broken, starting with the urge to tart up real-life anguish.
Body parts. I mean, people have been blown apart. They're dead.
That's Fox News' Sean Hannity's musical mayhem montage. Some say it was set to a theme from Doctor Who. Now, maybe it's unfair to use this as an exemplar of this week's coverage.
Make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this.
After all, Hannity's isn't a news show, and the blood-soaked video it used was running everywhere.
We will find out who did this. We'll find out why they did this.
Then there were all those mistakes, inevitable perhaps, in the fog of news. Early on, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times cited unnamed sources wrongly claiming more bombs had been found. The New York Post was first among many to wrongly label a Saudi national a potential suspect, and it kept posting pictures of people who weren't the bomber. The online community Reddit tried to find the perp by crowdsourcing photos and came up with a blue-robed guy who turned himself in to prove his innocence. Then they did it again to someone else. Other outlets singled out a brown sweatshirt guy, a running away guy. Basically, Gawker observed, every brown person wearing a backpack. But the weirdest episode occurred Wednesday, when first CNN, and then the AP and others, reported that a male suspect had either been arrested or taken into custody.
All right, we're going to interrupt Dana to bring John King back. John, you're working your sources, you're getting more information, exclusive reporting. What else are you learning?
Well, if we have information...
While NBC, CBS, and others reported officials denying it. NBC's Pete Williams.
At the end of the day, someone is going to be right.
Yeah.
Because every news organization is reporting something different. Pick your conclusion. Someone's right out there. I can only tell you what we have now been told by senior government officials.
CNN, first to report news of the arrest, was so sure, citing several unnamed local and federal law enforcement sources. But the FBI squashed its scoop, leaving nothing but a rank residue in its wake. CNN's John King.
Part of this reflects on us, but part of it also reflects on people that you talk to who are reliable sources. So when you have people who have been reliable sources, if they're out ahead of themselves, we need to go back and circle with them. And clearly, we need to figure this out ourselves. But you have, there's clearly something afoot today.
CNN ran with scissors and fell on the pointy end because they believe their government sources must know and would never lie. And people say reporters are cynical. There was something awfully familiar, though, about how it played out.
It's almost unheard of for FBI investigations to be leaked.
That's veteran journalist Ronald Kessler, author of The Secrets of the FBI, in 2004, referring to coordinated FBI leaks in the investigation of anthrax suspect Stephen Hatfill, who was found innocent.
The purpose of these leaks is to shake up the suspect and see what he'll do.
Coordinated FBI and police leaks have led to some of journalism's greatest blunders. They led an eager media to all but crucify the innocent Atlanta bomber suspect Richard Jewell in 1996 and the innocent suspected spy Wen Ho Lee in 1999. But in the Boston bombing case, it sure didn't look coordinated. Sometimes law enforcement authorities really just don't know. When they did know, they told us. Showed us, even enlisted us.
For more than 100 years, the FBI has relied upon the public to be its eyes and ears. With the media's help, in an instant, these images will be delivered directly into the hands of millions around the world. Somebody out there knows these individuals as friends, neighbors, co-workers, or family members of the suspects. Though it may be difficult, the nation is counting on those with information to come forward and provide it to us.
But that took a little time. Which brings us back to that police scanner in the wee small hours of Friday morning, followed and tweeted by so many, including OTM producer and chief Twitterer Alex Goldman.
I came home and I played Super Metroid for about 45 minutes, and then I thought to myself, I'll just check Twitter before I go to bed. And our Twitter feed was just exploding with sort of incomplete bits of information.
What was the story unfolding at that point?
There was an officer shot at MIT, and there was an ongoing shootout and car chase. It was really unclear to me what was happening. I looked at all the news outlets I could find, but of the major news outlets, CNN, I think, was the first one to cover it, and they were really sort of behind the ball. WGBH was doing a decent job. WCVB was doing a pretty good job, which is a local Boston station. I thought to myself, I should check out the police scanner.
We have reports that they have explosives here at the scene. There were explosives here at the scene.
I'm lucky to have gotten on it because at the time I started listening to it, I think there were 25,000 people listening to it. People were already having trouble accessing it. And by the time that I disconnected, I think there were somewhere in the ballpark of 80,000 people listening to it.
Were you tweeting the police scanner compulsively or did you have intent?
That's a tough question. I feel like my intent was just to give a sort of snapshot of the confusion that was going on the ground. I mean, a police scanner does not create a narrative. A police scanner is just a couple of people giving bits and pieces of information.
I don't know if that's true. I was following it like a narrative, a confusing one, a fractured one, a broken one, kind of a chronological mosaic.
But the narrative is so incomplete. It doesn't feel to me as though it paints as complete a picture as even just a dashed-off wire service news story. It just gives you sort of this concept of the chaos that was taking place. You know what I mean? You also have to consider the fact that they also use a lot of numbered codes, and they say them all very fast.
553 at 55 minutes. It's right above H2.
I feel like there's sort of a bit of encrypted information that, as a layman, I don't get.
Nevertheless, and maybe the movies have taught us this, they have this sort of zing of authenticity. And I asked on our feed, are scanner tweets any truer? One woman wrote back, yes, because they're on the scene. And then a man wrote, No, this is just a conversation. And sometimes the scanners make reference to things they've read on Twitter that are wrong.
Right. This morning, someone created a fake Twitter feed for the suspect that remains at large as of this recording and tweeted as though they were holed up and tweeting live from wherever they're hiding, and tweeted something about how they were going to kill everyone because the cops had killed their brother. And that got repeated on the scanner, which then got repeated by people on Twitter. So there is definitely a calculated risk to repeating stuff that's said on the scanner on Twitter. I mean, I made some of those same mistakes. There was a period of time where the police were saying they had a second suspect in custody, then they needed a positive ID on that. And I tweeted that, but later it was corrected by news organizations and the police to say that there was one suspect dead and one alive. I really tried to be as judicious as possible, and I even tweeted at one point trying to find corroborating info from multiple sources. And I was also following the Boston Police Department and the Massachusetts State Police on Twitter to see if they were delivering any updates. There was also a couple hours where it was unclear whether the first suspect taken into custody was alive or not. And there were conflicting reports not only on the scanner, but on mainstream news outlets.
So you did something that we criticize a lot of people for, which was report things before they're corroborated by police officials officially. That bothered you, right?
You know, I was really caught up in the sort of adrenaline of the moment, tweeting all that stuff. In the cold light of day today, I do feel a little embarrassment about it.
Didn't you say you felt like a schmo?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I felt like a schmo. Sure. I felt like a bit of a schmo. You know, Andy Carvin, who tweets for NPR, is famous for tweeting unconfirmed information and then asking his followers to sort of corroborate or discount that information.
But he's been criticized because by posting that information and asking for corroboration, he risks, and it often happens, that the material is retweeted without that ask attached as fact.
Right. And I tried to source my tweets to the police scanner to let people know exactly where I was getting my information. But if I could do it again, I probably would have been a little more judicious with the information that I got. And in fact, as more mainstream news outlets started reporting it, I transitioned off listening to the scanner and just started retweeting the information they were giving because I felt like it was more reliable.
I'm just curious. You do this. You get online and report breaking stories through the Twitter feed. You aggregate breaking stories. That's not really our brief. That's not what we do. But, of course, you handle the Twitter feed more than anybody. What drives you to do it?
Wow, that's a great question.
You could be playing Destructoid or whatever that game is.
Oh, Super Metroid. As much as I hate to admit this, and I'm almost scared that this is going to end up on the air, there really is a thrill to being the first or being as close to the first as possible to report a story. And I don't think that there's anybody who reports news that doesn't fall prey to that. And there is a real immediacy and sort of a stimulus response to tweeting. It's like pushing the bar to get a pellet. It's very seductive.
Alex Goldman, producer for On the Media, thank you very much.
Thanks, Burke.
Coming up, reporters for Runner's World had to improvise when instead of a marathon, they found themselves covering a tragedy. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Shutterstock.com, a global image marketplace on the web. Shutterstock.com helps creative people find images or videos for their next creative project. Shutterstock offers a collection of over 20 million high-resolution stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, and is searchable by subject, emotion, and other features. Any image in any size is available for one price. For a free trial and a special offer for our listeners, go to Shutterstock.com/PRI.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The day after the explosion, we hit a news lull. So many outlets filled their air with recycled video, speculation, sorrow on the scene, pundits, consultants, and blather. Personally, I think ABC's Dancing with the Stars had the right approach.
Our thoughts are with everyone
in Boston tonight. I have family members and many friends there. My heart is with you. ABC News is monitoring the situation back there. They'll keep you updated if we have any breaking stories.
Our entire cast is thinking about you. And as always, our show has been planned in advance, and hopefully we can still have an entertaining night of competition for you.
I found that tasteful. But then I don't have a daily two-hour call-in show. So on Thursday, I asked the best call-in host I know, WNYC's Brian Lehrer, how he determined how much was enough and how much was too much. He said that on the morning after, even though there was no news to report, to say nothing was impossible.
The absence itself is a canyon-sized void. In a situation like that, something so momentous just happened. Someone blew up the Boston Marathon. And we don't know who, and we really want to know who, and we think any minute they might tell us who, so we listen. What do you do if your neighbor's been shot dead? You gather around with your other neighbors, and you talk about the victims, and you speculate about the perps, and you tisk-tisk about what the world is coming to. I mean, that's just normal, and I think it's even good to want that, certainly from a talk show like I host. And even from a news program.
You said something that just pushed a hot button with me, speculating about the perps. This is something that all news was doing everywhere. It struck many listeners, and probably you too, that this is a very uncomfortable situation to be in.
There is a point where I think it becomes a kind of terrorism porn. It happened visually after 9/11. The attack itself, shown on TV over and over again, I think there was some of that with the video of the second explosion in Boston and that one old runner falling down. But I don't blame the viewers. The networks are trying to hook us, and they feast on our state of shock. And I think in the talk show realm, there's a kind of terrorism porn, too. I heard one commercial show where the host was literally putting it out there. Who do you think did it? People are just going to draw on their biases at that point.
But aren't you being a little inconsistent here? Because you're saying people want to come together in a community and speculate, and you're saying that they shouldn't.
I agree that I'm being inconsistent. And I think there's a line somewhere that's more art than science. And to some degree, you got to get it out. You got to let it out. But I personally would never frame a conversation simply around who do you think did it, as opposed to some speculation being allowed in kind of a larger conversation.
Did any listener call up and say, hey, all this other stuff has been happening in the news. Why don't we talk about that?
That happened. We didn't take those calls on the air, but there will always be those calls. Somebody called in to say, why don't you talk about the people who died in a bombing in Iraq today? And fair point. But you have to make a judgment as to what's going to be the most relevant and the most meaningful to people in the audience at a special and intense moment like that. And then make sure you don't do it all day, every day. That's when cable news really becomes junk, when they take those intense moments that are special and try to turn them into a format that they can do 27/365.
So how did you deal with it?
On Tuesday, being on 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, we realized as we were starting the show that nothing was changing. But still, we spent half the show on it at that time. And it was that combination of analyzing what was known, of taking calls for people's thoughts and feelings. My sense was that people really wanted to be in touch within the first 24 hours. People were still, and if we started talking only about other things, people would have gone looking for it. So that was for Tuesday. Wednesday and Thursday, we didn't mention it.
We spoke to WNYC's Brian Lehrer on Thursday. On Friday, his show did start with the latest updates on the overnight shootout and the ongoing manhunt, but he also talked about the immigration bill, New York City's school testing, and North Korea. During that midweek lull, we also asked listeners to let us know what kind of coverage they wanted to see in the absence of new information, and many responded. We spoke to three of them: Alex Hoffman, a 41-year-old education researcher from New Haven, Connecticut; Kat Danielson, a 28-year-old theater technician from Milwaukee; and Roland Duma, a 62-year-old psychologist from San Mateo, California. Roland explained what he wanted to hear from TV anchors when the news flow slows.
say what they know, say what they don't know. If there's unconfirmed rumors, say those are rumors, they're not confirmed, and then either repeat it and don't expand or go back to your regular programming. After they've exhausted their information, they keep talking. And when they keep talking, the best they can do is add no value. The worst they can do is feed emotion, prejudice. When they run out of data, they just fill it with blather.
Alex, you wrote very directly what it was you don't want to see.
I don't want the appeal to emotion, the grabbing for emotional community and connection through this mass media.
Why not?
I think that that role is largely being filled by social media. I'm looking for things that I can't get from my friends. These major media outlets, they should be curating information. They should be finding experts, people who know more than we do, who have better perspective than we do. Making me feel more emotional doesn't help me to make sense of any of these kinds of mass disasters.
Kat Danielson, what do you think of what Alex just said?
The intent of a bomber is to create a negative emotional response. Focusing on that negative really just gives them what they want. I would really prefer to see the good that everybody is doing and how much we have the capability to prevail over something like this.
I'm not saying that that shouldn't be covered, but I wouldn't want to put a filter on coverage that only gives us the positive and uplifting.
That's not what I'm looking for. I want to know what happened. I want to understand what happened, but I don't want to hear basically what I consider horror mongering. If you need it to fill the air, what I would like to see once you're done with all of the facts is stories of how people can help and how people are changing things for the better.
Can I ask you guys what you have been watching so far this week? We're speaking on Thursday.
Well, we're all NPR junkies, right?
So are most of your complaints then directed to what you heard on public radio, if that's where you stayed tuned?
No, CNN is the biggest offender.
Roland.
I accidentally clicked on CNN and they had all of these clips, and that's where I got the wild speculation. And I realized that it's news spam, in that the link or the station that says we know five things is going to get more listeners or viewers than the one that says we know two things.
I've got to say that a lot of my comments are coming from my using the NPR News app to listen to the WBUR feed, not just CNN. The criticisms that I have voiced in this conversation apply to WBUR as well.
I was actually at a family member's house, and they had on CNN. They just kept showing the same clips over and over again, and it was always the most horrifying clip. I've seen it a good 10 times in the 30 minutes that we were watching before we turned it off in disgust.
In the evening, I turn on my news, and I see my local San Francisco station had put a talking head and a cameraman on a plane to go to Boston to stand out in the location and basically read the cue cards left by the national reporters, you know, just to show that there's a local presence there. I was just furious that they're spending their money and wasting my attention to add zero information.
I'm suspecting that maybe the three of you are in a little bit of denial about the need to connect with a national community when this kind of thing takes place. Am I totally off base there?
Yeah,
you're off base.
Off base.
Way off base.
Many thanks to listeners Alex Hoffman, Kat Danielson, and Roland Dumas. On Wednesday, President Obama delivered a statement in the White House Rose Garden on the Senate's failure to pass a compromise bill to tighten controls on the sale of guns.
It represented moderation and common sense. That's why 90% of the American people supported it. But instead of supporting this compromise, the gun lobby and its allies willfully lied about the bill.
Obama had to walk a tightrope this week between battling for high-profile legislation on guns and immigration and consoling a nation. But Glenn Thrush, senior White House correspondent for Politico, says that reconciling what was happening inside and outside Washington wasn't as hard as it might seem.
I think the nature
of what happened in Boston really played into the larger issue that he was dealing with in terms of guns, and even to a lesser extent immigration. If we had still been engaged in this month-long fight over the debt ceiling or the fiscal cliff, I think the transition would be more jarring. But in general, for Obama, who is very deft at taking these situations and weaving them together into a larger narrative, the theme of violence and how to cope with it is something that he brought together. And I think that allowed him to come up with a more coherent message for the week.
Does it seem to you, as it does to me, with reference to optics, that the president seems to be moving from tragedy to tragedy to tragedy, whether it's Newtown or the storm Sandy that caused so much devastation here, or the Boston Marathon bombing, or even the explosion in West Texas this week?
I think the Gabby Giffords tragedy and then this unbelievable cascade of woe culminating in Newtown, which touched him to his core, has really transformed him as a president. You know, Obama's trajectory has been from a certain level of diffidence and distance into becoming someone who is much more comfortable feeling and sharing the pain of his people. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I also think it is having a concrete impact on his programmatic agenda. President Obama dodged this gun issue even after the Tucson shootings. There was no call for any sort of reforms in the State of the Union speech that year. That very much changed after Newtown and after the 2012 campaign. And now there does seem to be a dovetailing in Obama expressing this emotion publicly and moving ahead with an agenda that includes gun control.
Is there a template on how he deals with these tragedies?
Yes, I think there is. The way Obama has been dealing with it is really in sort of a Reagan-esque way, which is talking about each of these individuals and almost using their experience allegorically. I thought it was a really interesting contrast on Thursday in Boston when Obama spoke alongside his good friend Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts. Deval Patrick was addressing the larger meaning of the Boston attacks in terms of American civic life.
And just as we cannot permit darkness and hate to triumph over our spiritual faith, so we must not permit darkness and hate to triumph over our civic faith. That cannot happen. And it will not.
Really very evocative of Obama in 2007 and 2008. And then Obama came and gave a much more conventional speech that Ronald Reagan could have given in 81 or 82.
And we're left with two enduring images of this little boy. Forever smiling for his beloved Bruins and forever expressing a wish he made on a blue poster board. No more hurting people. Peace.
I think being around these people who have suffered so much tragedy moves Obama in a way that I don't think he had previously allowed himself to be moved as president.
So do you think that that can have an impact on legislation?
Look, even during the most bitter negotiation over the guns thing, I think this 2012 generation of party of no, small government, House members has really kind of crested. And you're seeing a new generation, I think, of Republicans in the Senate who are much more attuned to what's going on. The president has been having dinner with Republicans. I mean, we now have visuals of the president of the United States attempting to reach across the aisle. I think we are very much in the middle of this charm offensive, at least in terms of optics, and that's not going to stop anytime soon.
Glenn, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Glenn Thrush is senior White House correspondent for Politico. Staff from the magazine Runner's World were out in force at Monday's marathon, both reporting and running. In the aftermath of the explosions, those same reporters, who usually cover races and create training regimens, began writing about the unfolding national tragedy. David Willey, Runner's World editor-in-chief, directed his magazine's coverage this week. It was a big switch, but for him, not entirely unprecedented.
I was in New York City on 9/11, and I was an editor at Men's Journal magazine and edited a piece that was all about firefighters. And several people on the staff and several reporters that we gathered very, very quickly did amazing reporting on the ground. That came to mind for me immediately, and we asked five of our people to stay in the city to begin reporting, piecing together what happened.
But did your reporters know how to report this?
We don't have people who work at Runner's World come here because they didn't get a job as a war correspondent, and so they came to Runner's World instead. So no, nobody is equipped for that or accustomed to that. In Boston, we never saw our role as being investigative reporters who were going to be on the stories that all the other major media outlets were going to be on. You know, what was the bomb made of? What does the city know? We immediately decided not to even try to chase those stories. Our audience, obviously, is runners, and our job, and we do this 12 months a year, is to collect runner stories into a package of words and images and videos that help people make sense of what's going on from a runner's perspective. The mechanics of doing what we do really weren't that different. It's just that the conditions were hard, and obviously the story that we were reporting on was one of anguish.
I mean, when you're used to collecting pictures of champions, how do you even make editing decisions? You haven't made those before.
Right. We did look at some photos and talk about whether they were too graphic, inappropriate. We did not rule anything out, though. After talking about them, we decided to use them, even though they were, you know, very bloody and painful to look at.
This is a question that's come up a lot this week. When is enough enough?
Yeah, and it's going to be hard to see where that point is, to be honest, Brooke. One of the things that is so unnerving for runners about this tragedy is that it was an attack on the marathon, even though I don't think anyone was trying to attack runners or the marathon specifically. I think it seems, I'm guessing, but it feels that way to people who are runners. It feels very close to home. And we are not sure how this is going to play out for us going forward. We've all had families waiting for us running races and marathons. So the 8-year-old boy who was killed watching his father, it's just absolutely gut-wrenching. I have an 8-year-old son who stood on the street watching me run races more times than I can remember. I don't know how I'm going to feel about the next time I run a big city marathon. I absolutely have no problem doing that. I'm not changing my habits, and most of our runners feel that way. But I can't tell you with certainty today that I'm going to feel good about having, you know, my children standing in a crowd necessarily. So we're not going to know when this story is, quote, over for us for quite some time. But having said that, our readers do come to us for all kinds of reasons, storytelling, advice on how to improve their own running lives, and we can't stop doing that. We can't take our eye off that ball.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Brooke. Good to be with you.
David Willey is the editor-in-chief for Runner's World. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. A few weeks ago, we discovered the latest wave of so-called ag gag bills that would bar undercover journalists and advocacy groups from publishing images of abuse and illegality at industrial food processing facilities. It's a conversation that always invokes Upton Sinclair's 1906 book, The Jungle. Here's a bit from the audiobook read by Casey Affleck.
What they wanted from a hog was all the profits that could be got out of him. And that was what they wanted from the working man. And also, that was what they wanted from the public. What the hog thought of it and what he suffered were not considered. And no more was it with labor, and no more with the purchaser of meat.
Now, Sinclair intended his thoroughly researched novel to be an indictment of turn-of-the-century labor practices in the Chicago stockyards. But it wasn't the plight of labor that horrified the nation. It was the depiction of unsafe food production. In fact, our system of food safety inspectors, including USDA meat inspectors, owes its existence to the jungle. The jungle also inspired journalist Ted Conover, who's previously gone undercover as a Sing Sing prison guard and joined human smugglers crossing the Mexican border. In the May issue of Harper's, you can read his nuanced account of his latest undercover venture as a federal meat inspector at the Cargill plant in Schuyler, Nebraska. Lest you think that being an inspector offers a critical distance from the butchering of thousands of cattle a day, Conover quickly learned that his job entailed slicing into and laying his hands on the heads, livers, and hearts of our beef supply.
So these are parts of the animal which contain pieces, especially lymph nodes, that can tell about disease. And using a hook, you slice open the cheek and you cut into the lymph nodes and you're looking for infection. And you do the same on the tongue. And if everything's okay, you wait 10 seconds until the next one comes in front of you. If you're new, it's hard. It's hard to do the cutting well. It's hard to keep your knife sharp. It's hard to do it fast. And I was quite inept.
Tell me about livers and plot.
Livers was my favorite post because livers are easy to cut. The first cut you make into the liver is into the bile duct, and you're looking for liver flukes, which are shaped like giant paramecums. They're like half an inch long with cilia around the edge, and they're actually alive, and they get into cows through infected water. And if the liver has one of those, you stamp it, and then it goes into cat food. People can't eat that, but pets can. Then you make another cut into lymph nodes on the other side of the liver, but you also run your gloved hand over it because the thing about livers is they get abscesses inside, and the livers are like 10, 15, up to 20 pounds, and often you feel something bad, and then you give it two stamps, and then it gets rendered. That's not suitable for anything. And, you know, two-thirds of them have abscesses. It's really horrific and disturbing to look at, and I didn't know what that was about until...
Well, there was somebody standing there who you hadn't seen before, a tall woman with a clipboard who
exactly.
was neither an inspector nor a worker nor a manager.
Right, but she's watching us.
Watching the watchers.
I know. It made me a little uneasy. And I said to my coworker, I said, who's that? She said, oh, she works for Eli Lilly. I said, oh, the drug manufacturer. And I went and talked to her and I said, what are you doing? And she said, well, there's a correlation between the quantity of antibiotics in the cattle diet and the presence of abscess in the liver. This medicine to keep animals healthy helps them grow really fast. But it's given in such high doses, 70% of the antibiotics made in this country go into livestock. It makes them sick. Their livers get messed up trying to filter it out. That turned me off me, I must say.
You and your colleagues took this job very seriously.
Yes.
And there's this incredible moment in your piece when your fellow inspectors in the break room are watching video that was captured by an advocacy group of abuses at a different industrial livestock facility. Could you describe your colleagues' reactions?
Yeah. Somebody was reading the Omaha newspaper and saw that a new hidden video of this farm in Idaho, a dairy farm, had captured all this terrible abuse. And one of the supervisors went and called it up on his browser, and we all crowded around to watch. Cattle hit with plastic canes, cattle with broken legs being made to walk, cattle being kicked. And I was really curious to hear the inspectors' reactions because on the one hand, the inspectors tend to be farm people. They're from this part of the world. A lot of them grew up with animals. They don't have some of the romantic notions about humanely raised beef that city people sometimes have, and which I've also heard them mock. But they know cruelty when they see it, and none of them poo-pooed it. I was pleased because Schuyler just has 3,000 people, and everybody's job depends on the plant. And you worry about inspectors sort of cozying up, right, to the corporate entity there. I was really looking for that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You said you were really pleased to see how committed they were to the job they were doing, but as a journalist?
I was disappointed. But that's life. You got to call it as you see it. And they were conscientious.
One thing that your piece conveys so strongly, not unlike your experience as a prison guard, is the slow, steady toll of the work on the inspectors.
I feel bad complaining about it because the workers on the floor have it worse. They don't get to rotate their job during the day and do five different repetitive stress motions. That's what inspectors get to do, and inspectors get a couple extra breaks. Even with that, after about 10 days, my wrists and forearms got super sore and started waking me up at night. I've never had that happen. And after about 2.5 weeks, it was hard to turn the shower. It was a pinching motion. It was excruciating. And then 4 weeks into it, my fingertips were numb. Guys I worked with and women who'd been there 10, 15 years say, oh yeah, every day I start with 3 Advil. They live with the pain and there's no getting around it.
Why did you quit after 6 weeks? Was that always your plan?
No. Two things happened. I had trouble taking off my socks at the end of the day. I got worried about doing permanent damage. At the same time, after about a month, I was asked to fill out a very detailed background investigation questionnaire. And I knew I had to answer truthfully, but I also knew at the conclusion of that investigation, I would be out of a job. And I really didn't want to be called in and accused of being a rat and fired in front of people I was getting to like. I wanted them to be able to read my piece and see what I had said before they passed judgment on me. So at the very last minute, I quit. And I said to the people there who are my friends, you know, I'm going back to New York. I'm going to write an article about this. And they're like, okay, good luck with it.
You said you'd rather have them give you a fair shake by judging you on the work.
Right.
To see whether or not they got a fair shake. That characterizes all your work as an undercover reporter. Every piece of yours that I have read never seems to fulfill one's preconceptions. It's always much more nuanced. To do that, do you think you have to be an undercover reporter?
I think you need to be a participatory reporter and an immersive reporter. And if there are places you want to spend time, or people you want to spend time with, who you wouldn't be able to do that with were your true identity known, then I guess you have to do undercover reporting. But the part of undercover that intrigues me is not
skullduggery.
No, and the secret expose. I'm as much in favor of expose as anybody else. Love to read it. But for better or worse, I think a bigger part of me is interested in how people live and in the question of whether I could do that. Could I work in a prison? Could I figure out how to get by in a slaughterhouse? And how would it change me to do that? What if I hadn't had the privileges I've had growing up? Could I do it? Who would I be? It brings me alive.
Ted, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Ted Conover's report, The Way of All Flesh, is in the May issue of Harper's. Conover is a distinguished writer in residence at New York University. In 2008, Harper's Magazine released an anthology called Submersion Journalism, Reporting in the Radical First Person. It's a collection of Harper's articles reported more or less undercover. It's a controversial genre involving some degree of deception, ranging from merely not disclosing that you're a reporter to outright lying and fakery. When we first aired this piece in 2008, Bill Wasik was an editor at Harper's. Now he's at Wired. Howard Kurtz, who is still the host of CNN's Reliable Sources, told me he wasn't a fan of the genre.
I don't think we have to go around with a bullhorn saying, press here, please let me in so that I can expose your wrongdoing. But I think there is a very significant step, a gap between doing that and between taking on a fake name, fake business card, fake profession in order to go after what might be a very worthwhile story, but you're still lying to get it.
Here Kurtz is referring to a particular Harper's story in which writer Ken Silverstein donned a new suit and a pair of fake glasses, printed some business cards, and passed himself off as a consultant looking to hire a Washington lobbying firm to spruce up the rep of the hellaciously repressive nation of Turkmenistan. He found a couple of takers, happy to charge upwards of $1 million to seed the press and cozy up to congressmen. Silverstein named names and took some hits.
hits, as he told us in June of 2007.
I think there's a slight irony in some ways to the criticism of the undercover tactic in this case. I mean, to me, you know, it's okay for these lobbying firms to plant op-eds and to create bogus news events and to manipulate the media, but it's not okay for me to expose their dirty linen. I find that somewhat ironic.
Is it usually bad for a reporter to lie? Sure.
Harper's senior editor Bill Wasik edited Submersion Journalism.
But in the case of Washington lobbying for foreign dictatorships, we felt like that this was an instance where it was justified for Ken to create this identity to go and get a story that he wouldn't have been able to get through any other means.
And Wasik says it received an overwhelmingly positive response. Readers pay attention when reporters go undercover. Consider Silverstein's career, says Brooke Kroger, director of the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University.
You've looked back at his record. He has written about 20 pieces about Washington lobbyists since 1995, either for the Los Angeles Times or for the Harper's. Over 20 pieces. What he told me was that this is the only one that ever got serious, significant attention, a spotlight put on this issue.
Kroger wrote a biography of one of history's greatest undercover reporters called Nellie Bly, Daredevil Reporter Feminist.
She, in her very famous insane asylum expose, spent 10 days inside as someone who was deranged and came out to write about it in a huge two-part series that had just momentous impact and caused new monies to be brought into that facility.
Starting around 1887, Bly went undercover for a spectacular series of exposés. She spawned legions of imitators, and the practice persists to this day. Well, there was that controversial case in the 90s that looked as if it might kill undercover reporting for good when a jury found that ABC News had committed fraud when its reporters faked their resumes to work at the Food Lion grocery chain. The network was slapped with a $5.5 million fine. 2 years later, the ruling was overturned, though some critics did claim ABC had faked some footage, which ABC denied.
In many instances, it's the only way to get the story.
Pam Zekman is an investigative reporter for Chicago's CBS affiliate.
And if the abuse is extensive enough and affects enough people, it's justified so long as you don't break the law and you don't hurt anybody in the process.
For years, she reported for the Chicago Sun-Times, and she often went undercover to expose a wrong, most notably in a 25-part series that ran in 1978, centered on a little bar called The Mirage in Chicago.
But it could be almost any neighborhood tavern, any place.
Mike Wallace, narrating a 60 Minutes report on the story.
Actually, it's a story of corruption in city government. Inspectors on the take, bribed to overlook health, building, and fire code violations. Kickbacks. Tax evasion. Well, several months ago, some investigators and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times set out to determine for themselves how many of those rumors were fact in their city.
That would be Zekman, who said that small business owners were hurting but were afraid to go public.
And we had to, in order to prove this, become them.
The Mirage was, in fact, a mirage, a bar set up by the Chicago Sun-Times. When its doors opened, the crooks poured in, taking bribes in envelopes or directly from the register, all on camera. The celebrated series was up for a Pulitzer Prize, but was stymied by Pulitzer board member Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, who disapproved of undercover journalism. Zekman finds it frankly amusing. Now, since the Post had won a Pulitzer a few years earlier for Watergate, which relied on anonymous sources, a practice she believes is every bit as problematic as going undercover, if not more so.
I have always been a believer that the undercover technique, when there's no other way to get the story, is a truer way of getting at what's happening in an abusive area and a more credible way for the viewer or for the reader because they can see and hear what's happening. They don't have to trust that these anonymous sources exist. They don't have to make that leap of faith.
At least when a reporter goes undercover, you know who to trust or who not to. Harper's Bill Wasik.
When we do these first-person narrative stories, the writer comes back and essentially has to convince the reader through just an act of great writing and great journalism that what they've seen says something very important about the future of the nation or the future of the economy or technology or what have you. And so in terms of trust, it's a process that has to be built up every time.
Wasik says Harper's undercover reporters aim not so much to expose individuals as to slip past otherwise impenetrable public relations barricades to show how the world really works. Others do troll for individual evildoers, like NBC's Chris Hansen, who works with the police and uses human decoys to catch a predator.
You heard that right. Wants to take someone he thinks is a 12-year-old to a hotel for sex. But the decoy won't budge, so Cisneros gives in and shows up at the house. And he comes prepared.
So what are you doing? Did you bring condoms?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Hansen strides in, pad in hand.
I'm Chris Hansen, and I want to ask you some questions. Please have a seat.
Score.
That, for me, goes a little bit too far.
Journalist and author Brooke Kroger.
An argument could be made that law enforcement is set up to do some of those things. Is that really the role of a reporter?
So what is the role? To always be truthful to everyone, no matter who, no matter what? Former Chicago Tribune editor and publisher Jack Fuller is an absolutist.
We don't deceive our readers, and we don't deceive people we deal with, even if, from time to time, you end up missing a story as a result of it.
But Nellie Bly could not have exposed corruption and abuse and man's inhumanity to man without deceit. Sometimes a fake name is a ticket to a dark world of injustice desperate for the light of day.
Well, that's the best argument in favor of it. The best argument against it is that you have truth tellers lying. That's dangerous. I mean, that's the choice people have to make. You know, it's not an easy one. It's a judgment call.
The Washington Post's Dana Priest did not identify herself as a reporter to the authorities at Walter Reed Medical Center as she investigated horrific conditions there. But she did reveal herself to everyone she interviewed. She won a Pulitzer. How about Ted Conover, who revealed himself to no one when serving as a prison guard at Sing Sing for his widely admired book, New Jack?
He tried every other possible way to do that story, but felt it was very, very important to get inside of.
Brooke Kroger.
So he approaches this with the right kind of agony, I think, and that makes his work very powerful.
Conover told us that part of his reason for going undercover in an industrial slaughterhouse was to understand and convey the pain that enables the pleasure we derive from eating meat. It's a pain that he argues he couldn't get access to any other way. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alexander Hall. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ian Turner. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.